The end of the world is frequently predicted. Despite the lengthy litany of prophecies of doom which have failed to transpire, there remains an appetite for and a substantial culture and economy around some or other variety of apocalypse. The end of the world, if not necessarily nigh, is a thing that will happen. The sun is not an infinite resource. It will eventually gutter and die, which will likely cause life on Earth to do likewise. However, by the best guesses of pertinent boffins, this won't happen for another 7 billion years or so, and so is very much not the problem of anybody listening to this, unless the news podcasts of the 2020s have acquired a certain retro cachet 70 million centuries hence. But there are more short-term and more realistic such worries. It is also the case that civilizations collapse, whether due to overreach, decadence, complacency, disease, or war. Subcultures around the globe are preparing accordingly, in some countries, notably the United States, in considerable numbers. Where does this preoccupation with our own extermination come from? What effect do these fantasies of cataclysm have on real-world politics? And do those people preparing for Armageddon fear it, or actually kind of want it? This is The Foreign Desk.
Well, we're all still here. The much-hyped end of the world that was due today appears not to have happened.
Everyone on the planet is talking about the prediction in that 5,000-year-old Mayan calendar.
On May 21, there's going to be a terrific earthquake, way, way greater than anything that the Earth has ever experienced, and that'll be the beginning of Judgment Day.
Some have quit jobs or school to prepare for the end.
This story in The Guardian and the super-rich protecting themselves from Armageddon.
Yeah.
China is urging its citizens not to travel abroad as it struggles to contain the virus that has now killed more than 100 people.
For days, shoppers have been urged not to stockpile. But if scenes like these, filmed this morning, are anything to go by, the message isn't getting through.
We are on a fast track to climate disaster. Major cities underwater, unprecedented heat waves, terrifying storms, widespread water shortages, the extinction of a million species of plants and animals. And this is not fiction.
You're listening to The Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. I'm joined, first of all, by Dr. Michael Mills, lecturer in criminology at the University of Kent and author of Prepping and Verstehen, a narrative criminological perspective. And joining us from Washington, D.C. is Sarah Posner, an investigative journalist and expert on the intersection of religion and politics. Michael, first of all, would you say that doomsday culture is largely a phenomenon associated with conservative thinking, or is there an Armageddonist tendency on the left as well?
Based on my experience, and my kind of research background is based on face-to-face research with so-called doomsday preppers, there's a heavy leaning to the right in conservative circles in terms of the makeup of individuals who participate in that culture. Surveys that I've run suggest around about 85% or just above that of self-identified preppers tend to self-associate with conservative libertarian politics, so on and so forth. But not exclusively, as your question was getting to, really. I've also met, on the other side of the coin, anarchist preppers and kind of far left individuals who perhaps, I think maybe what they have in common with those on the conservative side of the spectrum is kind of a skepticism towards government and the state. And there's something that unites both sides of the aisle there, particularly when you're talking about individuals from anarchist circles. And also, I guess, kind of what unites them both as well would be a kind of a skepticism around kind of positive social and political change going forward, even though both sides would rationalize political issues very differently in many cases.
And Sarah, in the United States, that overlap between Armageddonist thinking and conservatism, what's the root of that? Does it come out of the, I guess, religious roots of both of those things? The conservative right in America usually thought of as being more religious than the American left.
Predominant apocalyptic thinking in American political culture comes out of American evangelicalism. It's very focused on the end times and the return of Jesus, and it has dipped into and perpetuated a lot of different conspiracy theories from communist takeovers of the United States in the 1950s to QAnon today.
Michael, you've spoken to a lot of preppers and survivalists who are planning for the worst. Is it your sense that these people genuinely believe that the end of the world is something they will live to see, or are they just playing along with the rituals of their particular in-group?
Actually, in most cases, it's neither of those things. And what's useful to understand is the external perception of prepping or preppers versus the actual reality of prepping itself. I think most of us coming to know prepping, not directly through people we know, but through the media, generally have quite a kind of a caricatured understanding of what preppers believe, what they're preparing for. In my experience, most preppers don't even rhetorically embrace the idea of preparing for the apocalypse, for the end times as such, but rather remain concerned about a spectrum of potential events, from minor kind of weather events, natural disasters. And in most cases, they're talking about a temporary breakdown of society in which government and wider society is not able to quickly recover. So it's not really the case that most preppers would speak in kind of delusional terms about things they don't really believe, but actually they would be the ones to tell you that they don't necessarily subscribe to apocalyptic thinking. And sometimes I think wider social concerns about apocalyptic thinking are actually projected onto preppers, and we assume that they think and act in certain ways that kind of fit with perhaps kind of certain formulas that pre-exist within movies, TVs, documentaries, the news, etc. So there is a gap between prepping as it exists and as we imagine it might exist.
Just to follow that up, Michael, and again thinking about the specifically UK context, I mean, obviously the whole world had an event a couple of years ago which might have reinforced a lot of the thinking of preppers and a fair bit of, I'm guessing, aha, we told you so. But also a few years before that here in the UK, we did have threats of various kind of Brexit, which did lead to a lot of people, not preppers at all, stocking up in a way that they had not previously stocked up. Is it your impression that here in the UK, those two events have given this movement a bit of momentum?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, though, those events kind of speak to what I was saying before to a certain extent, in that they show that the appeal of prepping extends beyond right-wing cultures inherently. This is not an intrinsically conservative phenomenon. I think they also show that the nature of prepping can be detached from apocalyptic thinking. Whether it's Brexit prepping or a lot of kind of COVID prepping, it's not necessarily premised on kind of a Hollywood fantastical idea of permanent societal breakdown. But it does show how perhaps increasingly, both in the US and outside, an increasing number of people are becoming interested in how they personally can plug the gaps in what they see as being deficiencies in wider social protections against different disasters, be they economic, disease-related, or X, Y, and Z beyond that.
Sarah, this may be a bit of a leap, but are we seeing here one of your classic transatlantic divides, whereby when the British think about prepping and think about preparing for the worst, they buy extra tins of baked beans and keep them in their basements, whereas Americans, there's this almost sort of melodramatic yearning for some gargantuan cleansing fire, the ultimate contest of good and evil?
Well, it's not that we don't have preppers here in the United States. We absolutely do have the kind of people that Michael studies and is talking about today. But in terms of, just to contrast in another way, you know, I don't study preppers, but I do, you know, study and write about evangelicalism in the United States. And COVID, for wide swaths of evangelicals, not all, but a wide majority of them, was not something that was apocalyptic. Their conspiratorial thinking made them believe that it was some kind of hoax or some kind of exaggeration by liberals. Anti-vax sentiments run high among evangelicals. So to them, COVID itself wasn't a sign of the end times, but many of them thought that perhaps COVID restrictions were a sign of what they would call a one world government or a tyrannical government trying to impose its will on the people. And vaccines were perhaps the mark of the beast, you know, which to them is a mark that is placed on you by the Antichrist government to basically like tag you or keep you in line. So again, apocalyptic thinking doesn't always run in the same direction. Your apocalyptic thinking might make you think that COVID is a sign of the apocalypse, or it might be a sign of the Antichrist trying to impose his will upon you.
At which point, Sarah, to follow that up, I'll put to you a variation of the same question I asked Michael earlier, which is when you research American evangelicals or talk to American evangelicals or even hear this sort of stuff just on your TV or online, Again, is it your sense that they literally believe this is true, that they think, for example, that a COVID-19 vaccine is some sort of mark of Satan? Or again, are they just conforming to the rituals and statements which they understand mark them, if you like, as a member of their own in-group?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. And unlike some other issues where there's a lot of agreement and homogeneity among evangelicals, on COVID, there was more of a split than their views on, say, abortion. There was, I would say, you know, a good third chunk based on public opinion polling that were taking vaccines, that were taking COVID seriously and so on. Still, I think the sentiment that COVID and the government's reaction to it, whether it was the federal government or local government imposing restrictions or mask requirements or things like that, because it fits well with their anti-government views in general, I think it was easy for people to slide into believing either that it was the mark of the beast, maybe not taking that seriously, but definitely believing that it was some kind of sign of what they might call government tyranny.
Michael, what's your sense of how it's evolving? Is the movement, as you've interacted with it, exclusively concerned with, I guess, just the practicalities of this stuff, what you should stock, where you should stock it, what you should have about the house, what you should be worried for? Because not all of this is going to be bad advice. Obviously, some of this is perfectly sensible housekeeping. But is it your sense that there is any kind of political ideology attached to any of this?
Well, absolutely. Most of the people that I've met in trying to explore various areas of prepping culture have subscribed either to conservative or libertarian thinking, or under some label that we closely associate with both of those or either of those. My sense is that there has been a change somewhat in the expectations or politics around the movement over time. There is some talk about an increasingly growing kind of progressive prepping movement. I don't really see signs of that. I think that long has been and continues to be a minority of the culture. The interesting change for me, I think, over time, to try and condense a longer historical story into a very short period of time, is that to begin with, a lot of the expectations that would be shared with me around prepping were about a very kind of open sense of possibilities in the world. And I think a lot of that reflected perhaps kind of a post 9/11 environment and kind of the trauma of that, and thinking about unknown unknowns, unpredictable disasters. And over time, prepping has been charged by the fallout from Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans, which I think to many preppers said the message that the government won't take care of you if something major happens, so you need to think and act for yourself. The election of Barack Obama, considering preppers' politics, was a major shot of unease and anxiety. But all the while, kind of preppers' outlooks, as they were conveyed to me, remained quite open, sense of unpredictability. I think the events of the last few years, picking up on what Sarah was saying about COVID, and many preppers maintain kind of a similarly kind of skeptic, perhaps not so extremely skeptical take on COVID. The fallout from the 2020 election with Joe Biden and a Democrat victory there, and the fallout from that election. My sense is that a lot of preppers I speak to are becoming more, or subscribing more and more to a resigned kind of point of view in understanding that this is kind of the beginning of the end that we're living in. So whereas previously there was a concern with unpredictable possibilities, there's a growing sense of kind of entrenched pessimism from the conservative and libertarian circles in which they run about the direction of the country in the long term, whether that's talking about some kind of apocalyptic disaster or a permanent decline in quality of life, freedom, etc. But my sense is there's a more kind of an entrenched resignation that surrounds the politics and expectations around all of this.
Sarah, Michael there mentions a couple of key moments, I think, for this tendency in the United States, which was the election of Barack Obama in 2008, the 2020 presidential election, and Donald Trump's refusal to admit that he lost it. But again, it's a question which I do also often wonder about: what motivates the people who subscribe to these movements, whether they are thinking about the end of the world or the end of civilization or merely the end of the republic. Where do you think the divide is between them fearing that outcome and at some level actually wanting it?
Well, I think the important thing to understand for Trump's white evangelical base is that, yes, the election of Barack Obama was a definite trigger or inflection point for them. And the election in 2016 of Donald Trump was another one, in that they believe that America was divinely founded as a Christian nation, and that liberal, secular, progressive forces over the course of most of the 20th century undermined that. And it's their job to restore America's Christian heritage. So for them, the election of Barack Obama was a declining moment. And for them, the election of Donald Trump was an inspirational moment. And therefore, they are very dedicated to Trump's stolen election lie. How does that fit in with their apocalyptic thinking? Well, you know, they sort of look at America like another Israel, where God has his hand on America and God wants America to be a Christian nation. And it's their duty to engage in politics and spiritual warfare in order for the forces of good to prevail over the forces of evil. And this is not the ultimate apocalypse that they're thinking of, which would be the apocalypse leading to the return of Jesus. They believe in that, but they also believe that in the moment, in this temporal moment, it is their patriotic and godly religious duty to engage in this kind of battle, this showdown between good and evil for the soul of America or for the restoration of America's Christian heritage.
Michael, I guess in closing, is it important to distinguish between, I guess, a practical idea of prepping and a more spiritual idea of prepping? It seems to me that the people you've been speaking to are mostly concerned with the former of those.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, there's overlaps between the communities that Sarah describes and the prepping community. But perhaps one really useful distinction to make, or an important one, is that whereas perhaps for a lot of evangelicals, and not to speak for Sarah's expertise, she'll know more about this than I, but salvation can be granted through external events, whereas a kind of a prepping ethic very much kind of reflects this idea that salvation, for want of a better term, lies in self-action, self-reliance, and that one has to act for oneself in order to maintain one's survival. So perhaps there's kind of a slightly different kind of outcome there in how they practically express themselves, these kind of united ways of thinking.
Dr. Michael Mills and Sarah Posner, thank you both very much for joining us on the Foreign Desk. It is one thing to ponder the end of the world, another to actively fear it, and a whole other level to actually start planning for it. Well, joining me now from Milwaukee is someone who has met the people who are doing exactly that. T. Krulos, journalist and author of Apocalypse Any Day Now, Deep Underground with America's Doomsday Preppers. T, let's start by thinking about the different kinds of apocalyptic concerns. In your survey of people preparing for this kind of thing, where would you say it breaks down in terms of natural disaster versus nuclear war versus some kind of divine punishment? Is there one kind of doomsday scenario that's prevalent?
No, I think all of those are things that people have concerns about. And of course, it's based a lot on their religious and political beliefs as well. But those are all concerns. And I think a lot of those people think there's going to be some sort of event. And it's not necessarily going to destroy the entire world, but it's going to set up a collapse of society. And people are going to be forced to kind of build their own fortresses to defend themselves against people who don't know how to survive. So they think there's going to be sort of an instigating event, and it's going to turn into this kind of zombie movie-like existence.
You spend a lot of time with the people who believe that this is likelier than not and are preparing accordingly. What sense were you able to get of how many of them were actually serious and how many were playing a kind of, you know, dress-up fantasy sort of thing, a bit like dressing up as soldiers in bygone Civil War battles on a weekend?
It breaks down a little bit into a certain group of people that I think are very sensible, and they just want to be well prepared in case there is some disaster and they're going to be forced to be stuck in their home for days or even weeks. And then you do have sort of a fantasy level of people who want to be in The Walking Dead or something and want to prove that they can survive. And they're influenced by pop culture. But there is a lot of stuff going on in the world that is really frightening. So I can see why people would go into that mindset. And then I think there is a group of people that are doing it more for fun. There's an event every year called Wasteland Weekend, and that's happening at the end of this month, actually. And I really wish I could go. I went to it one year and it was fun, and it was people just dressing up like they're in a Mad Max movie, and it takes place in the Mojave Desert, so the background is really perfect for it. And that's more of just like, I don't know, a fantasy celebration.
Quite a lot of what you're describing is basically sensible housekeeping. It probably does make sense to have, you know, food and water for a few days or a week about the premises if you can. I mean, most people listening to this will have relatively recent experience of being told you have to stay in your homes, you can't go out, and we're not sure for how long that's going to be. But in your travels among these people, did you start to get to a place of thinking there's a particular threshold? You know when somebody has gone a bit beyond just prudent housekeeping and has bought all the way into this?
Yeah, there's definitely people who they've gone past that line of sensibility, and you can tell that it's really an obsession. It's affecting their life very negatively. They have a very negative outlook on everything. And there's even a term for it. It's called doomer fatigue. That's when you are like thinking about doomsday so much that it's dragging you down. I don't know exactly where that line is, but definitely if your basement is filled up with canned food and guns and you're ready for it, then I think it's something you need to reevaluate because it's not a healthy level of concern. And you have to kind of accept, I think, that some things are out of your control.
How easy or otherwise, when you were putting the book together, was it to make your way into their communities? Were they reasonably accepting, especially of somebody who was there to chronicle the phenomenon?
It was difficult. I would say one of the more difficult groups that I've tried to talk to. I have researched other subcultures and social movements, so I felt pretty comfortable going into it. But one of the first things I did was I went to a prepper forum. And I introduced myself and I was very honest about it. I was like, I'm interested in writing a book and getting to know what your motivations are. And very immediately got attacked by almost everyone in the group. They were not happy to see a journalist was trying to be friendly with them. And so at first it was a very negative experience, but I did find some people who were willing to talk to me and show me around their houses. So I slowly was able to get to know people, but it took a lot of effort.
Did it strike you that there are people in this subculture who don't so much fear the apocalypse as at some level yearn for it, that they want some kind of cleansing fire to purify society and so it can be rebuilt?
Yeah, I feel like there is that mentality that you will encounter. And I get it. I mean, some days I take a look at humanity and I'm like, maybe we're done. Maybe this is where we should end things. But yeah, there is sort of this fantasy that the world will fall apart and I'm no longer have to go to my job. I can, you know, dress up in gear and pretend that I'm in an adventure movie or something like that. So I don't know, the world's a tough place.
Is there a particular, not so much political cohort that are more prone to this, but a geographical one? Is this kind of thinking more prevalent in rural than urban areas or the other way around or neither?
I think that the stereotype is definitely rural type of people who already have land and they're looking to defend it. But that's certainly not the case across the board. I met a very interesting prepper and he lives in the heart of Harlem. He's in an apartment building and he's in one of the most densely populated areas of the country. So he had an interest in it as well. And I think originally the stereotype was that there are very conservative Christian preppers. And this started to happen around the time Trump was elected. There was suddenly a rise of liberal preppers who were concerned about the future that the country was going into. So it really does transcend politics and economic backgrounds.
Did your time among the preppers end up influencing your own householding and your own outlook in any way? By which I guess I'm asking, are you now speaking to us from on top of a basement of tinned beans and ammunition yourself?
No, I thought it was going to change me because, like I say, I met some very rational people and I totally get that they have concerns. If you look at even last year in Texas, there was a snowstorm and the whole power grid went out and people were in very bad shape because they weren't used to being in a disaster like that. So when you see that or a hurricane that happens, then you're like, yeah, I should have a backup generator and a supply of water and some food and, you know, an emergency radio. So I started learning about it and I was like, you have to have the basics because otherwise I'm not going to survive more than 3 days out in the wild. And so I thought it would really influence me, but it turns out that I just kind of ignore it and haven't done what I thought I was going to do. I certainly don't think it's a bad idea, and I would recommend people, especially in areas where a hurricane or other disaster could happen, is you should think about having the basics. You don't need to go all out and get everything, but having some basic supplies will at least give you peace of mind, I think.
T. Krulos, thank you for joining us. T's book, Apocalypse Any Day Now, Deep Underground with America's Doomsday Preppers, is available in paperback. You're listening to The Foreign Desk with me, Andrew Muller. Apocalypse, Armageddon, call it what you will. It does sound terrifically final. There are, however, a few institutions whose work seeks, at some level, to mitigate against extinction. Well, joining me now from Norway is Osmund Asdal, a biologist and agronomist who also works as coordinator at the Svalbard Global Seed Vault. Osmund, let's start with a simple question, which is basically, what is the Seed Vault? If we went to visit it on Svalbard, what would we see?
Well, if you go there without being able to go inside, you will just see this quite iconic concrete construction pointing out of the hillside just close to the airport in Longyearbyen. If you're able to go inside, you will pass through a long tunnel and walk about 100 meters into the mountain, and you will end up in three seed chambers, which looks quite boring. They are quite simple. They are nothing special with them. There are shelves, and you will see a lot of different boxes on the shelves. And if you didn't know what was inside, you will think that this is quite an ordinary warehouse. But when you learn what's inside, you will think this is a quite fascinating place. The content of the Seed Vault is that the mission is that seed banks all over the world are invited to deposit duplicates of their seeds collections. They send these to Svalbard as an extra security, and if they lose seeds at home, they can always get the seeds back from the Seed Vault.
So how did you personally end up working there? And can you explain, if there is an average working day, what an average working day there is like?
I go to Svalbard with one or two colleagues three or four times during the year, a week at a time, and these weeks are quite well planned. During the year, we stay in touch with gene banks, both gene banks that already have some seeds and the potential new depositor gene banks. And we inform them about options for sending more seeds. We stay in touch for receiving what we call accession lists, which is a list of all the seed samples they want to send. We enter into new agreements with new gene banks that didn't deposit seeds before. We tell them to send the seeds to Svalbard just before what we call the Seed Vault opening weeks. They send the seeds to the Seed Vault, and we go there and bring all these seeds inside the Seed Vault and get in touch with the gene banks. Look, thanks for your cooperation. Your seeds are well inside, and we update the seed portal, and we tell them that we look forward to next seed deposit occasion. And actually, I spend quite a lot of time to talk with journalists like you, explaining about the Seed Vault mission and try to contribute to public awareness about the Seed Vault, about the importance of taking care of genetic resources of plants, and also encourage new gene banks and also politicians to both support plant breeding and their national gene banks, and also encourage the gene banks to secure the seeds properly.
How often does it happen that somebody wants to, well, literally withdraw from the seed bank? And how does that process work? How do you get the seeds to wherever it is they have to go?
The seeds in the seed vault are the property of the gene banks that sent them. So we never send seeds to third parties. It has happened just once that a gene bank wanted and needed their seeds to be returned. This was the International Center of Agricultural Research in Dry Areas, ICARDA, which formerly had their seed bank and also their headquarters in Aleppo in Syria. Luckily, they had deposited most of their seed bank collections in Svalbard from the beginning in 2008 up to 2014. And in 2015, they realized that the seed bank in Aleppo was inaccessible and not functioning. So they decided to establish new gene banks at ICARDA units in Lebanon and Morocco. This is an international center having units in many countries. So they decided to establish new gene banks in these two countries. And we returned during the following years the seed samples back to their new gene banks. And they were able to establish new gene banks functionalities. And they have already sent most of it back. They have produced new seeds and they have sent new copies back to the seed vault. And in addition, they have established functional gene banks there, distributing seeds to breeding and research, for instance.
I mean, that does prompt the question of how important the location of Svalbard is. Was it deliberately chosen to be somewhere that was very remote, very well defended by nature, and above all, likely to remain forever peaceful?
The story about conserving seeds in Svalbard started already in 1984. The Nordic Gene Bank was established in 1979, and quite early discussions started. How can we secure the Nordic seed collections? And after exploring a couple of options, it was decided that a coal mine in permafrost in Svalbard was chosen for depositing copies of the Nordic seed collection. And this was done from 1984. This solution for cost-free, very cheap storage of frozen seeds in permafrost there gained a lot of international attention. And to make a quite long story brief, after negotiations and the discussions in the international fora, Norway was asked in the beginning of the 2000s, would it be possible to build a global facility for conserving duplicates of seeds in Svalbard. Norway decided, yes, we can do this. And it was decided to build a new virgin seed vault, not in a coal mine. And it was also decided that permafrost is not sufficient. Permafrost in Svalbard is -3, -4, but modern methods of storing seeds require -18. So the seed vault is carved out of virgin mountain, and it also artificially cooled down to -18. So it's not dependent on permafrost, but permafrost provides a kind of extra security if something happens with the cooling system.
Osmond Asdal, thank you for joining us. That was Osmond Asdal, the biologist, agronomist and coordinator at the Svalbard Global Seed Vault. This is the Foreign Desk on Monocle 24. Finally, on today's episode, there are also scientists seeking to do for animals what the Svalbard Seed Vault does for plants. I'm joined now by Professor Michael Bruford, Director of the Frozen Ark and Dean of Environmental Sustainability at Cardiff University. Michael, first of all, tell us a bit about why the Frozen Ark is necessary.
Well, we are undergoing a pretty much unprecedented loss of biodiversity at the moment. And there are many different ways in which conservation organisations can help address that loss, or at least try to mitigate against it. One of them is through a process known as biobanking, which is ensuring that we collect, maintain in perpetuity, and analyse biological material from species that are going extinct or that are highly endangered to understand whether there are any generic processes that are making them under threat of extinction from a genetic level. And that's what biobanking really does. And biobanking for endangered species is really focusing on collecting material from endangered species before they go extinct, and preferably long before they go extinct, so we can analyze them and help correct the processes that are leading them towards extinction.
So what's the practical use of that genetic material in slowing or reversing the process of extinction?
There are two major ways in which genetic material can help. The first one is actually directly. For example, if a species is on the edge of extinction and is brought in to captivity before it goes extinct, one of the things you can do at that point is store its reproductive material. And there's a classic example of a species called the black-footed ferret, which is a ferret in the United States that they brought the last few individuals in the 1980s. They immediately stored semen from the males. And over the ensuing generations in captivity, because the population was very small, it lost genetic diversity and started to show signs of inbreeding depression. So individuals were being born with malformities. So what they were able to do was to go back to the semen that they collected in the 1980s and use that in the 2010s to reinvigorate the genetic diversity of the captive population. And they were able to bring it out of that kind of downward spiral that it was falling into. The second way is by collecting genetic material, you can understand how genetically distinct all the individuals are that are left in the captive breeding program. Oftentimes, the stud books are incorrect or they were founded from individuals that are unknown. And so you might have a captive breeding program that seems to be working well, but actually you've got hidden relatives that have maybe been mated together accidentally because you don't know the true genetic relatedness of everybody. And genetic material allows you then to do DNA profiling, understand then how related individuals actually are, and then optimize the mating and the breeding process so that you maintain as much genetic diversity as possible.
Theoretically, and this does get floated from time to time with creatures like the woolly mammoth or the Tasmanian thylacine, I don't know how scientifically illiterate these assumptions may be. I am aware that newspapers have a habit of taking flyers on things like this, but is that idea completely fantastical?
No, it's not completely fantastical, because gradually the technology and the methodologies are being brought together to allow it to happen. I believe personally that it's not the best way to go, because I would rather see us concentrate on what is possible with the species that do remain in existence than trying to resurrect species that have gone extinct. One of the problems with de-extinction, as it's called, is that what you're really looking at is reconstructing and recreating species that no longer have an ecological place in the ecosystem, whereas previously they did, of course. Since they've gone extinct, there may be new diseases that are floating around. And if you're able to start a population with a handful of individuals, just because you've been able to build the body with the carbon atoms and produce something that resembles what used to exist, doesn't mean that you've got an organism that knows how to behave, but you've got an organism that understands through learning from its parents, for example, the ecological requirements of its existence. And I think there are alternative things you can do. One of the things that the IUCN has been advocating is bringing in ecological surrogate species. So if you've got let's say, a giant tortoise on an island that was hunted to extinction in the 1700s, you could bring in a giant tortoise from another island if you wanted to recreate the ecosystem. That would be less risky and more easy to control than trying to construct a new species from scratch.
Well, to bring it back just finally then to what the Frozen Ark is actually doing right now, what's an example of a particular species you're working on at the moment?
Well, we're working on a huge number of species. Over the years, we've worked on species all over the world. The Frozen Ark operates a federated model, and the most important thing for us is that it's not just here in the UK where the genetic material of species is stored, but in the countries where those species exist. So we help countries establish their own biobanks. Perhaps the species for which the Frozen Ark is best known are a little group of snails that exist in the South Pacific called partula snails that were a group of species that have undergone an extraordinary speciation event on those islands where you get populations evolving simply because of the direction in which the coil on the top of the shell goes. And those species were being made extinct because of ill-advised introduction of giant African land snails onto those islands as a food source. And then what happened was the country realized that the giant African land snails were taking over the ecosystem, and they just tried to eliminate them. And they brought in a predatory land snail from North America, from Florida. And that species sort of had a go at the giant African land snail, but much more disastrously, virtually eliminated these partula snails that have been on the island for hundreds of thousands of years. And what the frozen arc has done is rescue the genetic material of almost all of those species. And so we now have both individuals and genetic material. And actually, animals are going back out into the wild. And there's been a really strong coordinated program to make sure that these tiny populations of endangered species with unique genetic diversity are properly identified in the first instance, bred in captivity, and then released back into the wild with the maximum genetic diversity that they need so they can evolve into the future.
Professor Michael Bruford, thank you very much for joining us on the Foreign Desk. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced by Emma Searle and Christy O'Grady. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. To contact the Foreign Desk team, you can email Emma at es@monocle.com, and don't forget to subscribe to Monocle Magazine and our free daily email bulletins by heading to our website at monocle.com. From me, Andrew Muller, thanks very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.